Message and data rates may apply. Consult a doctor prior to use.
Wow, you look amazing. What have you been doing?
I'm sure you've heard of Ozempic, Wegovy, and the other GLP-1 medications, right? Well, I found this great company called Zelthy. If you qualify, their providers can prescribe medications like Ozempic and Wegovy and other GLP-1 medications that are 80 to 90% less expensive, all 100% online.
I can get GLP-1 medications for 80 to 90% less and do it all online? No doctor's office or pharmacy?
Yes, Zelthy can provide semaglutide or tirzepatide, the active ingredients in Ozempic and other expensive GLP-1s. But for 80 to 90% less and ship directly to your door.
How do I get started with Zelthy?
Call #250 with the word care to get started today with Zelthy. Get the same active ingredients in Wegovy or Ozempic, but for 80 to 90% less and 100% online. Don't wait. Call #250 with the word care right now for a link to your exclusive offer. Call #250 with the word care. That's #250 with the word care. #250 and care.
This is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
Ukraine conflict. 2 years later, I welcome Anatole Levin of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft and highlighting and recommending the conversation that Anatole joined in with his colleague George Beebe of the Quincy and Michael Kimmage of the Catholic University of America, professor, about 2 years in, and what is to be done, and reminding me in the course of this conversation, quite spirited and comprehensive, about an hour, it's good listening. You can follow along with a transcript. It was moderated by Kelly Vlahos. Well done. What you learn is that your eyes on the battlefield, mine in particular, need to raise up. Get out of the battlefield, John. Look at the horizon. Look at the European Union, what it's achieved since the Second War. Look at what the Russians have given up in these 2 years. Look at the rest of the map. Don't just focus on will they or won't they fall back anymore. Anatole, a very good evening to you. Negotiations, we've talked of it for weeks. But in the course of the conversation with your colleagues, I was reminded all that Kyiv has in its hand, all the cards that Kyiv has because of its good working relationship with many leaders of the EU, as well as many leaders of NATO, all those cards that Russia must deal with in the pending negotiation. Did I hear that correctly, Anatole, that things are not as gloomy as Avdiivka indicates? Good evening to you.
Hello, John. Well, yes. I mean, in a negotiation with Russia, Ukraine does have some strong cards. It's suffered reverses on the battlefield, but you have to remember that, you know, in the past 9 months, Russia has only managed to capture two small towns in the Donbass at the cost of tens of thousands of Russian casualties. Of course, the complete destruction of those towns. Now, what that indicates is that although Russia can make further advances, to capture major Ukrainian cities would, you know, require colossal battles, enormous Russian casualties, and completely destroyed cities, which, of course, Russia would then have to rebuild again. So, the war is turning in Russia's favor, but by no means totally. And Ukraine has, you know, won really significant successes against the Black Sea Fleet. This presupposes that both sides are ready to negotiate. Now, Putin has said that he is, that he's open to talks. The problem is that the Ukrainian government and establishment, still their official position is that Russia must withdraw completely from all the territory it has taken since 2014, and that there must be war crimes trials and reparations. Well, and that there is no question of a treaty of neutrality. Well, that's just not going to happen. I mean, Ukraine is not going to suffer a complete defeat, but Ukraine cannot win now. It's very obvious. The sort of complete victory that would be required for Ukraine to impose those terms on Russia. So, I mean, what our paper was intended to say was, look, at present, in negotiations, Ukraine has some very strong cards, but so does Russia, you know, which forms the basis for a possible compromise. But all the indications are that down the line, you know, if Ukraine waits till next year or the year after, its position will get steadily weaker. Its negotiating position will be weaker. And we try to remind people that, you know, the Biden administration has several times said that the purpose of aid in Ukraine is to strengthen Ukraine at the eventual negotiating table. Well, I mean, if our analysis that Ukraine's position at the negotiating table is getting weaker, not stronger over time, that is a, you know, an argument to try to start talking now.
In the course of your explication of these matters, I believe the mention was of a visit in Kyiv recently by Ms. Nuland of the State Department and Mr. O'Brien of the State Department. Ms. Nuland is Deputy Secretary of State, and Mr. O'Brien is Assistant Secretary of State charged with European matters. Two very powerful speakers. And I wasn't sure how to take that visit because it indicated we've got a lot of tricks left. We've got a lot of power left. It sounded more battlefield-like. What is your measure of the State Department's approach to this? Do they see negotiation as necessary, as imminent? Are they ready to play those cards?
It seems that there are considerable divisions within the Biden administration. Some leaks have suggested that they are swinging to negotiations. But others, and of course, Nuland is a very notorious hardliner, have suggested no, you know, we are still trying to back the Ukrainians to victory. But when Nuland said that, you know, there are surprises in store for Russia, I mean, that you could read that different ways. I think that, you know, as we have found again and again in this war, like so many wars, you know, war is full of surprises. That doesn't mean that the Russians can be defeated, but it, you know, it does mean that with American help, the Ukrainians can impose serious losses and checks on them. But, you know, I've tried to remind people again and again that unless NATO puts boots on the ground in Ukraine, which every NATO government has said that it is not going to do, and Western publics are totally against it, if we're not going to do that, then the one thing that we cannot do is create more soldiers for Ukraine. And, you know, every report from the Ukrainian front lines talks about the Ukrainian soldiers being outnumbered and being exhausted by just having to serve continually in the front line because the Ukrainians have no reserves to spare. Well, you know, at some point that does raise the possibility, as happened several times during the First World War, that the Ukrainians might just, you know, run out of men on the battlefield and collapse. Well, at that point, I mean, Russia would still, you know, face huge battles to capture cities and massive losses. But of course, at that point, Ukraine would have suffered a massive defeat and Russia's position would be much, much stronger to impose its own terms on Kyiv and the West.
There's a deliberately provocative headline in the London Telegraph this morning, a remark by Medvedev, a man who has been president in between that period when Vladimir Putin stepped aside from the office, about how the war will not be won till we take Kyiv. I mention that because in the course of your conversation with the professor and your colleague George Beebe, the professor made it very clear that it's one thing to overcome a medium to small city, Avdiivka. It's another thing to face urban warfare, which Russia would have to face if it's going to take Kyiv. And what we've seen is in the first 2 years of war that Russia's not able or capable of fighting that without massive casualties and a complete dislocation of the general population. Urban warfare is a strain when you have air superiority, as the Americans have had many times. Did you take that point seriously, that overrunning Avdiivka is not the same as taking the Ukrainian cities?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the only major city that they've captured is Mariupol. And that, you know, took months and once again, massive casualties and the complete destruction of the city. Well, Kiev is something like 12 times the size of Mariupol. It is 50 times the size of Avdiivka. Yeah, I mean, that would be, I think, beyond Russia's capability. And, you know, I think also we probably shouldn't take what Medvedev says too seriously.
No, I don't, I mean, but it entertains the heck out of the Telegraph headline writers.
Well, yeah, I know, and maybe he has a license from Putin, perhaps, to say these kinds of things, you know, to frighten the West. I don't know. But, I mean, in the end, the only person we really have to listen to in Russia whose words, you know, really count are those of Putin himself. You know, if Putin declared publicly that Russia has to take Kiev, that, you know, that basically the conquest of the whole of Ukraine, maybe minus the West, is still Russia's goal, then by God, we should sit up and take notice. And then I myself would say, you know, if Putin declares that, then there cannot be, you know, talks for a compromise peace. He's ruled it out. But Putin has not actually said that, certainly not over the past year. So, you know, the question is still open. And the only, you know, in the end, the only way of testing what Putin wants is to talk to him. You know, I often have to laugh when some Western journalist, not yourself, of course, ask me in interviews, what is Putin thinking? And I say, well, you know, the last time we cracked a bottle of vodka together, I was going to ask him about Ukraine, but, you know, he spent his whole time talking about his family, you know, and his last holiday. Of course, I don't know what Putin is thinking. You know, ask him, for God's sake.
Anatole Levin of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, in conversation with his colleague George Beebe and Professor Michael Kimmich of the Catholic University of America. Yeah, I recommend listening to the whole interview. It's about 50, 55 minutes. We're going to turn now to an event in these last days that has surprised and at the same time disappointed all of the leadership of the EU and NATO and the United States, the death of Alexei Navalny on unknown circumstances. When we come back, this is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.